At this time, I'd like to introduce you to our speaker this morning. Dr. Vic Anderson brings a wealth of experience to our gathering today. For over 30 years, he's been a pillar of theological education in Ethiopia. His passion for preaching God's word extends to his local church here in Texas, in Mesquite. In addition to preaching in his local church, he holds a PhD in intercultural education, and he currently heads the PhD office at Dallas Theological Seminary. And as one of his students in his program, I'm hoping this Sunday will somehow earn me some extra brownie points. Dr. Anderson and his wife, Cindy, demonstrate their dedication to sharing the gospel in their ongoing summer missions, demonstrating a beautiful intersection of faith, scholarship, and service. Please join me in a warm welcome for Dr. Vic Anderson.
Thanks, Chris. Man, some guys will stoop to anything to get brownie points, right? Thank you, Chris. You actually make me sound as old as I am. It's been about 15, 18 years or so since I actually first met Jace and Hannah back when they were students at Dallas Seminary. They were students of mine, and I was early on in my career at Dallas Seminary, and I remember they weren't married at that time. And I met them and separately thought, wow, these are really good people. God's blessing seems to be on them. I wonder how life will work out for them. And here they are. You have been blessed to be able to receive them. I'm so glad that they can be part of your church and part of your leadership. And Jace, thank you for inviting me to come and be with Grace Bible Church this morning. It really is delightful for me. I'm delighted to be with people who are from this church. You have a long tradition, a long history of being people who love the Lord and love the Word, come enjoying the opportunity to worship together. And you join people from all over the world on Sunday because it is the day when the people of God worship. And we are the people of God, right? People who are called out from the world, chosen by the Father, redeemed by the Son, being transformed by the Spirit, and journeying together to that great day when the reign of Christ will fill the earth. So good to be together. This morning, I'm going to reveal to you the most significant, innovative software development of all time. No, it's not the development of Windows or the Apple iOS operating system. It's really good to have those graphical user interfaces, but it's not that. It's not the development of speech recognition, although it's really quite cool, right, to be able to speak to a computer and it understands what you're saying and can translate you into multiple languages. It's not even the upcoming development and launch of wide-ranging artificial intelligence, which seems to do anything that humans can do only faster. Now, there's something much more significant than any of those developments. It's one key, the undo key. You know, it's that key that on your keyboard or in your software, it looks like a broken off U with an arrow on the end. And all you have to do is click it, and the bad things that happened go away. It's really quite clever, you know? I mean, when you're able to, you need a different word, type the wrong word, undo, goes away. You made an alteration to a graphic that has certain colors that you don't like, click undo. It reverses, goes away. Or even if you type a whole paragraph and realize, you know, that's not what I really wanted. You hit undo, and it reverses your work. What a wonderful thing. How did we ever get along without undo? It would be great if everything in life could be reversed when we realize it's not really what we wanted, right? Sometimes it works that way, but not often. It was just a little while ago, I made a purchase that I shouldn't have made. You ever do one of those? I got scammed. I clicked to order something and then realized that a couple days later, oh man, they took my money. So I called up the credit card company and I said, hey, can you reverse the transaction? And the woman at the other end of the phone said, "Yes, sir, Mr. Anderson, we'll be happy to do that for you." I was so happy. Something that was evil got reversed. They had their own little undo key for me. Of course, most of the bad things in life, the evil things in life, are not so easily reversed. There is this avalanche of evil that can bury us in our lives. Some of us are in the middle of it even this morning, because you have had in recent days perhaps a financial setback. Some bills have come in, or a job that hasn't worked out to quite provide for you as you thought it would. And then there has been the breakdown of your car or a major appliance, and perhaps your phone stopped working. And then there's piled on the death of a family member or a close friend. And then you find out that one of your children makes a terrible mistake. And the avalanche of evil against us is overwhelming. And you sense there's nothing I can do to turn this around. And what was a life of joy becomes a life of bitterness. Maybe for you, it's not the personal attacks. It's just listening to the news and recognizing that we live in this culture, this society where evil seems to be cascading down upon us in an unstoppable way. It is the recognition that every day fentanyl is coming across the border and hundreds, if not thousands, of people are being killed by this drug. It is the news that perpetrators of violence who should have been imprisoned are not. And other people who have done nothing wrong are in prison and they're waiting for some justice. It comes when we recognize that our desire to see the life of the unborn protected, that desire is being thwarted even by pharmacological technologies and loopholes in law. And now we even hear of how our children are being told by teachers and others, "Oh, it's okay for you to choose your gender and you can change along the way." And medical imposters are hitting them with drugs and surgeries to cause irreparable harm. And the avalanche of evil seems irreversible. It is overwhelming. And if we're not careful, the result of that will be a life turned bitter. For we can become angry with God because we know that He could fix it. He could hit His undo key. But He doesn't. Where do we find hope that God will reverse this evil? Where do we get any sense that one day God is going to move from this cascading avalanche of evil and put everything in its place? We want to try to answer that question this morning, and we're going to do so by looking at an Old Testament story that tells describes how God took a destitute, bitter widow and brought a great reversal to her life and the life of all of Israel. What we're going to do is spend some time looking very carefully at the story and some of the details that are so important, and having examined that story, we'll look at what we would do to demonstrate a faith in that kind of God. So an examination and a demonstration. I hope that you will find this story fascinating, for it is. We're going to look at a whole book of the Bible, all four chapters, and I promise we'll get done by supper time, okay? We're in the book of Ruth, so I invite you to find your place in the book of Ruth, whether you have it on your phone or in a Bible, and what we're going to find is that we'll start off meeting a widow, a woman named Naomi, and she is bitter. because she is overwhelmed with evil. And she has a life that at this point in the story, she is hopeless. We're in Ruth chapter 1. We break into the story at verse 19 and listen to how the author describes it. So the two women, and that would be Naomi, the destitute widow, and Ruth, her daughter-in-law, the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women exclaimed, can this be Naomi? We'll stop there for just a second. So what is happening here is that these two women have been walking for a while. They were in another country, a country known as Moab. We'll talk a little more about that in a few minutes. But they have now been walking for some time across desert and over hills. And imagine they stumble into this little hamlet of Bethlehem, a bit dusty and bedraggled. You know, they didn't come in on a nice Amtrak. They didn't come on a nice bus. It's been a long time for Naomi, the Israelite, to be away. And as she arrives in town, we would kind of expect her to cause a bit of a stir as people would come out and say, it's Naomi. She's back. She's back. How good it is. And they would put their arms around her and give her a hug and welcome her back home. Instead, they see her and they see perhaps the expression on her face. And they ask, is this Naomi? How could it be? We actually expect Naomi to be quite filled with a sense of enthusiasm, anticipation, as she comes back home and she says, you know, I'm coming back to the streets that I grew up on. I know all these people. I know all these places. This is home. Been tired of eating the food in Moab. Now I'm going to have some home-cooked meals. Surely she'd be excited and happy. But in her opening statement to the townswomen, we find out that she's quite bitter and angry. Look how she says it there in the verses that follow. Chapter 1, verse 20 says, "Don't call me Naomi," she said to them. "Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord, he's brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune or calamity upon me." Naomi shows this remarkable level of bitterness. Her heart is not filled with affection toward God, but anger toward him. And you can hear it in her words, right? How she says, just call me bitter, not pleasant. I consider myself not full, but empty. Ouch. Imagine the shock for those who heard the words from the lips of Naomi. Why so bitter? Why so angry? Well, there's a combination of reasons given here in this text. Let me highlight just a few of them for you. The chapter begins by saying that this all happens in the time of the judges. Now, you're all Bible scholars, so you know that the time of the judges in Israel, it's not a good time. I don't think the author is simply giving us a chronological marker. You know, there was the days of Moses and then the Exodus from Egypt and across the Red Sea, and then the baton was handed off to Joshua, and Joshua led the people into the land, and they fought the battle of Jericho and began to overtake the land, and then came the time of the judges. But in the time of the judges, everyone did what was right in their own eyes. In fact, the text describes it as a time of famine. I take it famine indicates that the blessing of God is not occurring. And so Naomi has fled the land in the time of the judges. In order to find food and keep her family alive, she and her husband go to this distant land of Moab. Moab is not a good place. It's historically a place that's very kind of anti-Israel. We'll come back and talk about that in a minute. But they've been there, and it's been over 10 years. And when she was there, she had husband, sons, got daughters-in-law. And I imagine her life was filled with a sense of anticipation that Grandma Naomi is going to have children, grandchildren that she can enjoy, and God would take care of her. But instead, she says that the Lord has brought bitterness to her life. Did you see it? Five different ways about how the Lord has been against her. Verse 20, the second part, the Lord has made my life bitter. Verse 21, he caused me to be empty. The second part of verse 21, he opposed me or afflicted me. Her words there are, God has testified against me like in court. He's been like a prosecuting attorney against me. Back in verse 14, she had said in chapter 1 earlier that the Lord's hand was out against her, using the imagery of a warrior smiting down his enemies. And then she makes this climactic statement at the end of verse 21, the Lord has brought literally evil upon me. Whew. Naomi is a bitter woman because life has been bitter. You see, back in Moab, she lost her husband, and she lost her sons, and she's come away empty-handed. She has no children, which of course, that's sad, isn't it? It's really sad when somebody wants to have children. But in Israel, to not have children is to mean that you're missing God's blessing. It means that you have no economic security. Remember, there's no pension plan. There's no Social Security. There's no retirement provision except for your children. There's no remembrance of your family without children. You'll die in obscurity. And perhaps worst of all, you don't get to keep the land, the precious promised land. Naomi has nothing. And we can hear Naomi's cry. You could have stopped it. And she's angry that God has not reversed the situation. So she says, change my name. Don't call me Naomi. That means pleasant. Call me bitter, Mara. Because that's what life has been like. She has become a victim of evil. We feel for Naomi, right? We've all had some sense of what it's like to be at the end of your rope. To be able to say, you know, the circumstances of life and the evil that has come up on me like this avalanche, I cannot stop it. I cannot reverse it. And God is not showing any evidence that he will either. We can share Naomi's bitterness. And so we ask, what hope do we have that God will ever reverse that? Well, that's the rest of the story. And if we had time, we'd read all of chapter 2 and now all of chapter 3 as God begins to work out the greatest reversal you can possibly imagine. But we're going to skip those chapters so that you can read them this afternoon. We're going to move up to chapter 4, where the story comes to the great conclusion, and we'll see how God completely reversed this evil that Naomi was experiencing. Ruth chapter 4 and verse 13 says, 4:13, so Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. Boaz, who's Boaz? Boaz is a man in Bethlehem, a very wealthy man, a righteous man, a man who has actually been used by God to be a source of blessing to Naomi and this daughter-in-law, Ruth. Boaz met Ruth when Ruth came to his field, and he gave her privileges of taking grain home. He gave her extra barley. He took care of Ruth. And her mother-in-law, Naomi. And then he graciously agreed to take Ruth as his wife. He did not have to, but he chose to do so so that the family name could go on in the land. And then you have this great statement of the rest of the reversal in verse 13. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. And when he made love to her, the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. The women said to Naomi, "Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a guardian redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age, for your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better for you than seven sons, has given him birth." Naomi took the child in her arms and cared for him. And the women living there said, "Naomi has a son." And they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. And in a few short verses, the author has compiled a statement that God has so completely reversed the overwhelming evil that Naomi experienced. It just sounds like this wonderful, happy romantic story, right? I mean, poor widow woman comes to town, meets wealthy farmer. He gets struck by Cupid's love arrow. He falls in love with her, marries her, provides for her. They get married, have a child. Everybody lives happily ever after. Nice little cute story, right? Except there's so much more going on than this. Because what the author is showing us is that God has reversed overwhelming evil. There are several features of this reversal. I'm gonna quickly move us through three of them that are staggering in their scope. Because what we're going to find is that Naomi went, first of all, from a position of insecurity to high security. And then a second feature of this reversal is that she has in Ruth something that was an unwanted liability that gets reversed to a most valued asset. And then thirdly, from a legacy of insignificance to a legacy of significance. You ready? Lots of stuff to explore. Reversal number one, or feature number one, a reversal from Naomi's insecurity to high security. Now, as I mentioned earlier, for Naomi to not have a child is devastating because it means there is no future for no future security, right? You're going to die destitute, probably die young. And yet, what does the text say here in verse 14? It says, "The women said to Naomi, 'Praise be the Lord who has not left you this day without a guardian redeemer.'" Talking about the baby. You gave birth to a baby who's going to be your guardian redeemer. In other words, this is the person who pulls your life out of destitution and will guard you and provide for you. And as your bones get old and tired and your body becomes weak and your eyes no longer function and you can't work in the field, you have a boy who will be your guardian redeemer. In fact, it says in verse 15, he will renew your life. Literally, it says he's going to be returning of life in old age. Now, you and I don't talk like that. I'm sure your translation doesn't say return your life. But the authors use a concept in Hebrew and actually some word choice that's really important for the book of Ruth. Because you remember, when Ruth and Naomi are returning to the land of Israel, Naomi says to her daughters-in-law, "Yo, you return to your land and your gods." And Ruth says, "No, I'm going to return with you, and I'll go where you go, and I'll be with you, and I'll be with your gods." And then the text says they return to Bethlehem. And the author keeps reminding us that there's a lot of returning going on. And finally, you come to chapter 4, and he says, "This boy who's born is going to return to you, Naomi. Life itself, the life you thought you lost." This is the great reversal. Surprise, a son has been born to, did you catch it? To whom? to Naomi. Wait, I thought Ruth gave birth. She did. But the author surprises us when she says a son has been born to Naomi. Surprising on a couple of levels. First of all, this old woman didn't give birth to a son. And second, in normal way of describing a child, you attribute the birth connection to the father. So what you expect the author to say, oh, that this son is born to Elimelech. Or this is a son of Boaz. But no, he says, this is a son of Naomi. The author is basically highlighting this complete reversal of Naomi's status from insecurity to high security. This is done by God for her. A second feature of this reversal. She sees in Ruth going from an unwanted liability to a most valued asset. Couldn't be more different. Look back at the text. Notice what she says there in verse 15. Her sons are dead, but she gained a daughter-in-law who is better than seven sons. Wow, that's pretty good. Seven, a number of completion in the Bible, often a number for perfection. Now, to have one son is good. To have three sons is even better. To have five sons, whoo, that's amazing. To have seven sons, well, your cup is overflowing. And what do the women say? Oh, your daughter-in-law, a daughter, a foreigner, is better for you than seven sons. It's a remarkable statement that basically highlights that Naomi went from deficit to a family surplus through Ruth. Her whole situation has been changed. Ruth was unwanted and unvalued, right? You remember when she came from Moab? Hey, Ruth, go back. I don't want you with me. Ruth said, I'm coming. When they arrive in Bethlehem, does anybody talk to Ruth? No. No one even sees her. She's a foreigner. In fact, she's so unvalued because she's from the Moabites. Moabites, they are not good people. That's the nation who hired Balaam to prophesy against Israel. The Moabites, they came from an incestuous relationship between Lot and his daughters. The Moabites, they were banned from becoming members of Israel by the law. No one's going to run out and say, oh, I'm so glad you have a Moabite with you. I suppose that Naomi's even looking at the dust, not wanting to acknowledge Ruth's presence. But Ruth's status is completely reversed by the end of the book. Because the Ruth, who's always connected with Moab, ends up becoming Ruth connected with Israel. When you go home today and you read through the book, I want you to notice that every time pretty much that Ruth is mentioned in chapter 1, 2, 3, 4, it's Ruth the Moabite. Over and over. The sons married Moabite women. Ruth the Moabite, who came from Moab. When she comes out to the field in chapter 2 to meet Boaz and the farmers, no one says, oh, it's that widow woman who came with Naomi, the one with the long brown hair, the one who's a hard worker. No, the text says it's Ruth the Moabite. And every time she's mentioned, it's a Moabite. When Boaz introduces Ruth, or the author describes Ruth in chapter 4, the first couple of times, she's Ruth the Moabite. It's like the author is just driving home this connection. And then Boaz marries her. And she's blessed by God. And the text says, Boaz married Ruth. Not Ruth the Moabite. Ruth. Ruth, the one who's now has a status of being an insider, an Israelite. I think the silence is intentional. Ruth has changed from liability to asset, from an unwanted to most valuable. Fascinating. So we find that Naomi experienced this great reversal of evil, from insecurity to high security, from an unwanted liability with Ruth to a most valued asset in Ruth. Let me give you one more feature of this reversal. Naomi goes from a legacy of insignificance to a legacy of super significance. Remember that when she comes as a widow from Moab back to Bethlehem, she faces this obscure death. No one is going to be caring about her. No one from outside of Bethlehem will know about her. She will live her life a few more years, and she will die and be buried. And 20 years from now, no one will know who Naomi is. Wasn't she that woman Mom told us about? The one that was in Moab for a while? But now everything changes, because the text says that this one who's born to Naomi via Ruth, the one named Obed, is the link between Judah and King David. Wow. Can't get much more significant than that. Because God had promised long ago, when the 12 tribes came through Jacob, through Israel, that one of the tribal heads, of course, a man named Judah, that the king would come from Judah's line. And so often it was threatened. It looked like it wouldn't happen. And God is going to be at work to bring this foreign woman, this Moabite, through a widow, Naomi, in order to be able to give birth to the one who will become King David. Everyone will know who Naomi is. From a legacy of insignificance to great significance. What a reversal. How did God do that? Two great features here of God's work. He works providentially through his people. God reverses evil providentially through his people. Let's think about, first of all, how he works through his people. God worked through the loyal love of Ruth and Boaz. Through Ruth, who bound herself to Naomi, who said, "Where you go, I will go." She gives covenant loyalty to this mother-in-law. And God works through that loyal love to reverse the evil. Through Boaz, a man who's not obligated, really, to do what he does to keep Naomi and Ruth alive and to marry this woman and bear children and make sure the land goes forward through her, but he does. And God works through generous, loyal, loving people to reverse evil that was so overwhelming. Not only does God work through people and their loyal love, he works providentially. Providentially. That means he works slowly and silently. God works not all the time with sudden intervention, like, you know, a plague upon Egypt, or a crossing of a Red Sea, or a knocking down the walls of Jericho. Providence is more like the turning of a big dreamliner. Ooh. Takes a while. Sometimes you can't even tell that it's turning. And then you realize God has moved this in a completely different direction. God worked slowly and invisibly over decades, reversing a famine, bringing the women back, providing for them through Ruth and through Boaz, causing Ruth to conceive a child, positioning that child as a critical link across the generations to bring David to Israel. I find it fascinating that Ruth could not have known that God was doing all that. Boaz had no idea that when he took that woman to be his wife, that he was God's cog to reverse evil. But that's what was happening. So this is how God reverses evil. He does it providentially through the loyal love of his people. May I suggest to you that if we believe that, and we must, that there are a couple of ways we can demonstrate our faith in that God, a couple of ways at least that we can proclaim by our own actions that that is our God. He is our God who reverses evil providentially through the loyal love of his people. First demonstration is this. We wait patiently for him to reverse evil. We wait patiently for him. And that is so hard. Some of us are struggling, perhaps even this morning, because our years have been filled with pain and we've prayed that God would reverse evil and he hasn't done it, as we've perhaps been estranged from a spouse, or we have a wayward son or a wayward daughter, and it seems that God is not acting. But in faith, we wait patiently for God to act. Some of us have felt the crush of evil when the doctors have said it's terminal and we can't reverse it. And the evil seems overwhelming. And we demonstrate our patience, we demonstrate our faith in this God with a patience, anticipating he will one day reverse the evil. But it's not just faithfully, patiently waiting. It's also being like Ruth and Boaz, men and women who will engage in loyal acts of love for the suffering, for the bitter, for the downcast. For just maybe you and I get to be the Ruth and the Boaz for a Naomi in our lives. Pick a person. Pick some action and love them and love them and keep loving them. It'll cost you some money. It'll cost you some time. It'll cost your presence, but just maybe God will use you to reverse evil in someone else's life. I don't know, maybe the undo key isn't the greatest software innovation of all time, but I tell you what, our God, when he reverses evil, so remarkable. We have the privilege of as his people to be a church full of people who have this kind of faith in this God who reverses evil by his providential work through the loyal acts of love from his people. May God stimulate our faith and our action. And so, our Father, I thank you that you are so good to be in the business of reversing evil. And we confess that so often we just want it now. Lord, we want it all tomorrow. And yet we acknowledge that we want to be people of faith who will wait for you. So help us, I pray, to do as you would have us to do, and be channels of blessing to people who are suffering around us. For Jesus' sake, amen.